The headquarters building was in the fort's plan, but had not yet been built. Hollander rode down to the adjutant's office, a small structure at the south edge of the parade ground. Tying his horse, he lifted off the saddlebags containing the fort sill dispatches and stepped through the door. He saluted the officer of the day and noted with some disappointment that Captain Richard Newton held that honor. Newton returned the salute without getting up from his desk.
Hollander, I didn't think you'd ever come back.
I just took a leave, not a separation.
I expected your new in-laws to use their political pull and get you a soft post back east.
That would have pleased Newton in two ways. It would have rid him of Hollander, and it would also have given him legitimate grounds to grouse about the Army's lack of fairness. Not that he had ever waited for legitimate grounds.
As you can see, Captain, I'm here. I brought some remounts and some recruits from Sill.
He flopped the dusty saddlebags on the desk. Newton made an annoyed show of waving the dust away.
I hope they're better than the last bunch. They were hardly worth the bringing.
The men or the horses?
Newton's eyes narrowed.
Either. There's not much difference between one and the other. How did we get ourselves trapped into a black regiment, Hollander?
Looked to us like an easy ticket to promotion. Not many officers wanted the assignment.
Easy ticket? Trying to teach the impossible to the incapable? It's rare when one of these darkies can even read and write. You and I sit up half the night doing paperwork that would be delegated to enlisted men in a white outfit.
A price we paid to avoid competition.
Newton frowned. He had never appreciated Hollander's disconcerting way of stripping matters down to bare essentials. Naked truth was like naked men, unattractive at the least, and sometimes downright ugly. Like them, it needed dressing up. But Frank Hollander knew exactly why he and most of the other officers were here. Nor did he entertain any lofty illusions about the motives behind the organization of the 9th and 10th Cavalry, or the two infantry regiments that shared their blackness. Negro units had served the Union during the war, and the new regiments were in part an effort to utilize this military experience. But of stronger immediate interest to a revenge-minded Reconstruction Congress had been the opportunity to humiliate the defeated South by occupying it with black troops, giving the former slave authority over the former master. That later events had turned these soldiers into Indian fighters was incidental, and more or less accidental.
And when are you going to let us plebeians see the blue-blooded bride?
Hollander had long sensed Newton's resentment over his correspondence with the daughter of a New England merchant who had access to influential offices in Washington. Newton's own wife was a plain and complaining woman who sent his hard-earned money home to her hapless father in some Illinois crossroads town. That gentleman could not influence the outcome of a dogfight, much less the outcome of national legislation, or the promotion of a deserving son-in-law to higher rank in a comfortable post worthy of his abilities and family connections.
There is no bride.
It might have been Hollander's imagination that a fleeting smile touched Newton's face. Newton stood up and looked out the front window at the half-completed officer's row.
At least we won't have to listen to all the junior officers' wives cry about being bumped to lesser quarters.
Colonel Matthew Thomas stepped into the office and Hollander saluted. Smiling, Thomas responded with an offhand salute that wouldn't be tolerated from a recruit.
Buchanan told me you just rode in, Frank. I hope you brought something with you to brighten the post.
Hollander knew what he meant.
No, sir. Unless you count some fresh horses and fresh recruits.
Thomas's smile faded.
I thought that was the purpose of your leave.
Thought so too, sir.
Thomas nodded sympathetically and let the matter rest. He was a large man, wide of shoulders, beginning to soften and spread around the middle as his rank kept him tied more to the garrison and allowed him less time in the saddle. Thomas had given up dreams of military glory and had resigned himself to quietly performing his duties with neither flash nor complaint until he was of age to draw his pension. Newton moved aside so the commanding officer could thumb through the dispatches Hollander had brought.
You'll find the horses 11 head short, sir. A raiding party hit us in the Colorado crossing.
Hollander told it all, including the valorous counterattack by new black recruit Gideon Ledbetter.
I realize it is up to your discretion to apportion the recruit, sir. But I would consider it a personal favor if you would see fit to assign that man and his partner to my company. I believe that my Sergeant Nettles could turn them into top soldiers.
Thomas nodded.
Write their names down for me. This post needs all the good soldiers it can get.
Captain Newton mulled over the report.
Hollander, you are telling us that you let a dozen or so Indians get away with 11 horses? And you with 30 men at your command?
Hollander tensed.
Command is hardly the word for it. They were recruits. Most of them didn't even appear to know how to fire a rifle. If I had gone and pursued, I would more than likely have gotten men killed without recovering the horses. I thought I was fortunate not to lose more than the 11 head.
Newton's mood was dark.
Fighting is what they're paid for. Better to train men in battle than in retreat.
Hollander felt no necessity to explain himself to Newton, who outranked him, but nevertheless was only a company commander, as was Hollander himself. He turned to the commanding officer.
I had to make a decision in the field, sir. It was my judgment that the best course was to minimize my losses. But if you would like to put the matter before a board of inquiry, sir...
No, Frank. I'm satisfied with your report. If we court-martialed every failure against those damned Indians, there wouldn't be half a dozen field-grade officers left west of the Mississippi.
Newton's long military experience had taught him when to pursue a subject and when to drop it. He would not wish his own failures enumerated.
I was just inquiring, Hollander. No offense was meant.
None was taken.
Colonel Thomas set the matter to rest.
My wife has been looking forward to welcoming your bride, Frank. I do not want to be the one who disappoints her. I propose that we step over to my house and you tell her yourself over a glass of brandy.
I'm a bit dusty and trail-worn, sir.
If that perturbed her, she would have turned me out 30 years ago.
Hollander had rather serve 3 days as officer of the guard than explain the unpleasant details to Elizabeth Thomas. But the matter was settled. Looking at Officer's Row, he felt the sting of his loss. He had expected to be moving into one of those houses with a warm and smiling wife at his side. It was a short walk to the commanding officer's quarters, a modest stone structure with a wooden porch, looking about the same as the other buildings completed thus far on the south side of the quadrangle. The Army saw little reason for variations, except minor ones of size, to recognize differences in rank. Hollander scraped his boots carefully and stamped each foot to dislodge some of the dust. This was more a matter of form than of substance, for Texas dust had a stubborn way of clinging. Like the flies, it might rise momentarily, only to return to place as quickly as the disturbance was over. Putting rank aside, Thomas held the door open. The lieutenant removed his hat.
Elizabeth, I brought a young lieutenant to pay his respects.
It was customary for an arriving officer to pay a duty call upon the CO's lady, though Hollander was hardly new here. Elizabeth Thomas, a small, thin woman whose large, alert eyes saw everything, appeared in the kitchen doorway. Deep tracks had been etched into the corners by what those eyes had seen. Before she spoke, she removed her apron quickly, laying it across a plain, high-back rocking chair.
Frank Hollander! I had begun to wonder if you were ever coming back. Welcome to this house.
She extended her small hand, the fingers well-suited to playing the piano, a pleasure she had long been denied at a succession of frontier posts. Hollander bowed slightly and kissed her hand in a manner that some were beginning to regard as old-fashioned. He noted the dark spots spreading on her skin, betokening the years.
The greatest pleasure of being back, Mrs. Thomas, is to see your smile.
It was the sort of thing a young officer was expected to say, and he meant it, more or less. He could not in good conscience have said the same thing to Richard Newton's wife, for he had seldom seen that woman smile. Mrs. Thomas looked expectantly past the two men, her thoughts transparent.
I came alone, ma'am.
Then she is to follow you later?
He shook his head.
There was no wedding.
Oh.
She forced a quick, shallow smile.
There will be. Love always triumphs in the end.
I'm afraid that was the end, and it didn't.
He sensed that his eyes betrayed the banked coals of anger he had been suppressing.
I'm sorry, Frank.
She turned toward the small sitting room.
I have tea making on the stove. Or perhaps you men would prefer something stronger?
Frank has had a long trip, and I lured him here on the pretext of giving him brandy.
Then brandy it shall be. You men have yourselves a seat.
Hollander waited until the senior officer had seated himself, then eased into a well-used horsehide chair that some previous commander had not seen fit to take with him when he left. If it was not army issue, the chair had existed on borrowed time for years. In the adjacent dining room was a small, somewhat battered walnut china cabinet. In the cabinet were remnants of a fine china service, gradually reduced by the hazards of frequent packing, hauling, unpacking, and packing again as the colonel's restless career led him backward and forward across 100 long and bumpy military roads. There was a saying among army wives, 3 moves was as bad as 1 fire. Mrs. Thomas took a cork-stoppered bottle and 2 small glasses of etched crystal from another cabinet.
These are, I fear, almost the last survivors of what was once a proud and noble company. Matthew's parents gave us a set of crystal and china when we were married. Please don't ask me how long ago that was.
She poured Hollander's glass full of a nut-brown brandy, then filled her husband's.
If you men don't mind, I shall confine myself to tea. The spirit is willing, but I fear for my digestion. Excuse me?
The colonel waited politely until she retreated into the kitchen.
Something has upset her the last few days. I fought the water.
Hollander glanced at the door to the kitchen, reflecting on the daily hardships endured by army wives in such outposts. Denied simple comforts other women took for granted in the smallest of towns in the East. If they were fortunate enough to have a house instead of a boarded-up tent, that house was likely to be hot in the summer and drafty in the winter. Here at Concho, the stone walls and rough wooden floors regularly yielded up scorpions and centipedes, and occasionally a rattlesnake crawled in over an open threshold. Aside from whatever the military families provided for themselves, the furnishings were most often plain and thriftily utilitarian. Whatever possessions the woman might own were at the mercy of careless enlisted men and uncaring mules every time a move was made. Aside from game, the food tended toward the bland and monotonous, bordering on the inedible. The water was never to be trusted. The prudent boiled it before use. Few Western garrisons had ever suffered direct Indian attack, so garrison women ordinarily faced that danger only on the move. But they were always exposed to the frontier's less spectacular but even deadlier perils, such as cholera, malaria, or those mysterious and incurable maladies of a dozen manifestations lumped together simply as the fever. Man, woman, or child, these hazards respected no non-combatants. Elizabeth Thomas returned carrying a saucer and a steaming cup. Hollander stood up quickly and waited until she seated herself before he sat down again. While out of sight, she had seized the opportunity to brush her long, graying hair and to button the sleeves she had rolled partway up while she worked in the kitchen. Here on this isolated post, she tried diligently to present a symbol of polite civilization as she remembered or imagined that civilization to be. The effort was well-intentioned, and Hollander acknowledged that it needed to be made, although often he felt it was futile. In the end, the wilderness would overwhelm these little islands and bury them without a trace. He tried to picture his former fiancée, Olivia Walburton, where Elizabeth Thomas sat. The transfer did not fit. Probably everything had turned out for the best, but knowing that didn't make it hurt any less.
I don't mean to pry, Frank, but are you certain there is no hope?
It's over. I'm not what she wants.
I can't understand that. Any young lady would be lucky to have such a wonderful...
But she didn't feel that way. Nor did her mother and father, especially her father. He tried to persuade me to leave the army and work in his mercantile business. He said he could use his influence to get me an immediate separation. He said a soldier could never support his daughter in the style to which she had every right to remain accustomed.
You won't always be a lieutenant, Frank. Someday you'll be a captain, then a major, and eventually a colonel.
She stopped, looking around the Spartan room, seeming to realize how hollow her case sounded. Her husband was a colonel, and yet they lived on the edge of poverty.
Her father said any man content with a soldier's lot had little ambition, and a man who would associate himself with black soldiers obviously had no ambition at all. It amounted to an ultimatum. Stay in the army and lose Olivia, or leave the army and she would condescend to accept me.
Mrs. Thomas automatically took a partisan position. So long had the fabric of her life been interwoven with the military that she thrilled like an old soldier to the piercing call of the trumpet or a sharp roll on the drum. Any insult to soldiers in general was an insult to her in particular, for she was army to the bone.
You did the right thing, Frank. There are lots of other young ladies.
Not out here.
After the breakup, he had stopped off in Washington to get gloriously drunk and to temporarily work off his frustrations and pent-up hungers in one of the gaudy, red-tasseled institutions that specialized in such service to officers and other professional men of moderate means. He had not left until his means and his hunger were well spent. On the long trip back, the hunger had returned, but not the means. He stared at the 10th Cavalry coat of arms hanging on the colonel's parlor wall. Atop it was the shaggy form of a buffalo, symbolizing the black buffalo soldiers, and beneath it a war bonnet and pair of crossed tomahawks, symbolizing their mission. The troopers were proud of that emblem, and he supposed he should be too. It had cost him enough. A movement at the kitchen door drew his attention. He saw a slender, large-eyed girl wiping her hands on an apron. He stared in surprise. Because she stood in shadow, it was a moment before he realized she was not white. She was a mulatto, or perhaps a quadroon, her skin nearer olive than black. Her eyes rested briefly on the lieutenant, studying him with open curiosity, though she spoke to the colonel's wife.
Yes, Hannah?
You ready for me to put the roast in the oven, Miss Thomas?
Yes, go ahead, Hannah.
Yes, ma'am.
The girl backed through the door, watching Hollander until she disappeared into the kitchen.
I don't remember seeing her before.
She showed up on the post after you left. She lives with her granny over on Laundry Row. She works for me part of the time, and the rest of the time she helps the old woman wash and iron soldiers' clothes.
I would wager she has the full attention of all the troops.
Mrs. Thomas shook her head.
Her granny watches her like an old brood hen. I've seen caning marks on Hannah.
I would think the old woman might have to use her cane on some soldiers, too.
Mrs. Thomas frowned.
They would deserve it. If they can't control their baser natures, they can indulge them in that sin trap across the river. They need not debase my kitchen help. Yes, what is it, Hannah?
Miss Thomas, which seasonings do I put on the roast while it's cooking?
I'll come show you. Gentlemen, if you will excuse me.
The colonel's wife retreated to the kitchen. The colonel looked to be sure she was gone.
I strongly suspect that at least a couple of my bachelor officers have taken a new interest in cleanliness since that girl has been on Laundry Row.
She's black.
Not very black.
Gideon sensed animosity in the silent Big Dempsey as they walked toward the corrals from the hospital, leading his brown horse. He felt alone and ill at ease, for the post was new and large and full of strange people. He had never met people easily. On the plantation, he had never had to. His left arm, freshly bandaged, seemed dead except for a dull throbbing that just bordered on pain. He felt sluggish, wrung out, wishing he could crawl somewhere cool and dark and be forgotten for a day or two. He tried to make conversation.
Is this Concho a good place?
When you're a nigger, there ain't no good place.
They reached the corral. Dempsey studied Gideon's stiff arm with suspicion and stood back, letting Gideon slide the bar and open the gate for himself. Leading the brown in, he could see that his fellow recruits were briskly currying and brushing their unsaddled horses, while Sergeant Esau Nettles restlessly stalked among them, hands knotted into hard fists set threateningly on his hips. The crackle in his eyes was as loud as a shout.
You're missing a place there.
This was directed at a nervous black trooper.
Now you ain't done till I can't see one speck of dust, one trace of sweat. You're on the horse, I mean. I want to see lots of sweat on you.
He turned his challenging dark eyes to Gideon and Big Dempsey.
Dempsey, this ain't where I put you to work.
Dempsey did not cringe.
Your favorite lieutenant sent me to guide his pet pup back. afraid he might get lost or something.
He turned and walked toward the hospital building. Gideon felt the sergeant's eyes focus upon him. He had seen more friendliness in a white overseer the morning after a bad drunk.
Private Ledbetter, sir.
He saluted the best he knew how. Nettles was not impressed.
You don't salute sergeants, not even a top sergeant like me. You don't call me sir, neither. That's for white officers.
Yes, sir.
He had never gotten it straight in his mind who was an officer and who wasn't. It seemed to him he caught hell from everybody who had one stripe or more on his sleeve. Nettles gave him a hard stare that Gideon's eyes couldn't meet.
You got lost time to make up. Get the saddle off of that horse. Grab you a brush and curry comb. Around this outfit, the horses get groomed and fed before the soldiers do.
Yes, sir.
Flustered, Gideon unbuckled the girth. It was awkward, working with only his right hand. He tried to use his left, but it hurt. Jimbo abandoned his own horse and stepped around to help him. Nettle's hands went back to his hips.
Damn it, trooper. What do you think you're doing?
Helping him is all. I'm kind of one-handed.
You got enough to do taking care of your own damn job. And if that ain't enough, I'll find you something else. On this post, every man totes the load for himself.
Jimbo glanced apologetically at Gideon and hurriedly retreated. Gideon slipped the light saddle off, picked up a brush, and began trying to work the dust and sweat out of the brown horse's hair.
The harder you brush, the better he'll shine.
Jimbo made one more effort to help.
Sergeant O'Gid got his arm hurt by them Indians.
Nettles withered him with another stare.
The only time you speak without permission is when I tell you to.
He turned back to Gideon.
Maybe you got that arm hurt, and maybe you looking for the lieutenant to give you a soft time of it. But around here, it ain't the officers you need to be scaredest of. It's me.
Gideon already was.
Yes, sir.
He brushed harder, forcing his left arm into service.
I got eyes in the back of my head, and I don't have no trouble seeing through a soldier that's trying to slack his duty.
Yes, sir.
Nettles fell silent, but Gideon could feel the eyes on his back. He brushed. The pain rose. His left arm felt hot.
Just a minute, trooper.
Gideon turned. Nettles parted the torn sleeve. A red stain was seeping through the fresh bandage. The work had made the wound bleed. Nettles' eyes were still fierce.
Why didn't you tell me, soldier?
Gideon looked at the ground. He couldn't meet that sharp scrutiny. Nettles beckoned to Jimbo.
You, the one who talks all the time. Since you're so goddamn anxious for extra work, come here and finish grooming up this horse.
Jimbo grinned and saluted.
Yes, sir.
Nettles gave him a glance that branded him a hopeless case. He jerked his head at Gideon and walked out of hearing of the other men. He leaned against the stone fence.
You told me what you're doing out there, and I don't put no stock in daredevils. They're generally crazy, or else trying to work some shenanigans to get themselves soft duty.
Gideon hoped somebody, someday, might listen to him.
Sergeant, it wasn't none of them things. That brown horse just got afeard and run off with me, is all.
Nettles studied him in surprised silence.
I tried to tell him. None of them didn't want to hear what I was saying. Lieutenant says I'm a hero. Doctor says I'm just crazy.
And the truth is that you just can't handle your horse.
I reckon that's about it.
Well, we'll teach you how to do that. And as for the rest, I don't see no need to disabuse the lieutenant of his notions by forcing the truth on him when he don't want to hear it. You got something to live up to now. Maybe it'll make a better soldier of you.
But there ain't no truth in it. I ain't no hero.
In this army, you're what the officers say you is. Let them down, and they'll stomp on you. And then I'll come along and finish what's left. That tell you what's expected of you, boy?
Gideon shrugged, burdened by the heavy weight of expectations.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
You just do what I tell you. You satisfy me, and them officers won't be no hurl at all.
When Hollander had talked to Gideon and Jimbo about joining the army, what he said had conjured up pictures of them wearing splendid blue uniforms, cutting a dashing figure as they rode gallantly across the plains, protecting the helpless settlers from the merciless savage. The settlers' gratitude would be boundless, and the soldiers' selfless efforts would help build beautiful cities in a waste and a wilderness. After more than a month at Fort Concho, Gideon thought it probable that Hollander had had some other place in mind. Gideon had not been more than a mile from the post since his arrival. The only settlers he had seen were a rude lot in that huddle of stone and mud and stick houses known as Over the River. He had ventured across to St. Angela one night with Jimbo. Neither had money for more than one drink of whiskey, but both were eager for a try at the ambrosia they had heard about all their lives. Neither had been allowed to taste it on the plantation. Gideon had expected it to have the kiss of angels about it because of the sacrificial lengths to which men would go. The drink had been painful and disillusioning. It had tasted more of the devil than of angels. When Gideon and Jimbo finished their only drink and did not buy another, the barman brusquely told them to leave the crowded place and make room for thirstier customers. So much, then, for the grateful settlers. As for savages, since that day on the Colorado River, he had seen none, unless he counted the man in the bar. Neither Gideon nor the other recruits had been sent to chase a single Indian. What they had done instead was to feed, curry, and comb the horses, to drill afoot and on horseback until he sometimes forgot which was his left hand and which was his right, and most of all to work as laborers on the construction of the post. They carried cut stones for the German masons whose language was incomprehensible, but whose frequent displeasure was manifested in ways unmistakable. With picks and shovels and crowbars, they hacked and punched ditches and foundation footings into a ground that seemed nothing but alternate layers of solid rock and hard-packed, dirty white material known locally as caliche. If Hollander hadn't exactly lied, he had left out a lot. Gideon and Jimbo had spent much of the morning helping dig a ditch destined to become a latrine. The glowering Big Dempsey was with them, as well as a little man named Finley, whose incessant talking would worry ants out of a hole. The hard ground resisted every assault and gave up no more than a few chips at a time.
Damn it!
Dempsey swung his powerful shoulders behind the pick. Often the point struck sparks, and the handle shuddered with the impact. Sergeant Esau Nettles stood above the men at the top edge, looking down upon the results of their labor and finding them meager.
You're trying to break off too much at a time. Take a thinner bite, and it won't fight back so hard.
The big man gave him a look not far from rebellion.
Yes, sir, Sergeant.
He kept on striking the point of the pick in the same place. Finley worked little but talked much, so that the others would have been glad to dispense with his help and be rid of the noise. Gideon was using the shovel a little farther down the ditch in a layer of caliche already loosened by the pick. He felt the sergeant's disapproving eyes light upon him. He was convinced that Nettles watched him more than any other man in the company. When he spoke to Gideon individually, it was always with a curt order, a sharp criticism. Nettles had no respect for any recruit, and he seemed to have singled Gideon out for particular displeasure. Gideon swung a shovel full of dirt and caliche toward the rim of the ditch, but in his nervousness he scraped the edge and spilled most of the load. Nettles scowled.
Ledbetter, when you was a slave and worked for nothing, you was overpaid.
Gideon gloried in, but fiercely suppressed a wild notion of throwing the next load into the sergeant's black-whiskered face. Like others in the company, he had lain awake nights, his body wearied to the bone, and had dreamed of finding an appropriate revenge someday. No method properly fiendish had yet presented itself, but it would, he had faith. The Lord provided to those who had patience. Lieutenant Hollander walked out from the corrals.
Ten hut!
The men dropped their tools and snapped to attention, despite cramped backs and aching arms and legs. Hollander returned Nettles' salute and looked dispassionately at the ragged hole that could not yet properly be called a ditch.
You men carry on with what you were doing.
Dempsey swung the pick. He omitted the cursing, not out of respect, but out of better judgment. Jimbo raised a crowbar and drove its point at the edge of a rock layer. Not a chip broke off. Gideon forced his shovel into the caliche.
Good morning, Charger. Your arm's still doing all right.
Embarrassed, Gideon paused. Hollander's attentions had earned him a lot of hard looks from the other men in the company.
He's healed, sir.
That's fine. I want you in good shape the first time we go out after the Indians. I want you to show these other men what a soldier can do.
Warmth came to Gideon's face. He stood there feeling foolish, still holding a shovel full of earth. The sergeant frowned at him. Hollander jerked his chin.
Sergeant Nettles, I need to talk to you. Let's go up to the corrals.
Yes, sir.
Nettles looked at the men.
Keep on working. I see the prairie dog move more dirt than all of you.
As soon as Nettles was gone, Big Dempsey pitched his pick aside. Damn. He sat down, hanging his legs into the hole. He glared at Gideon.
Your name ain't Charger.
The sergeant had told them to keep working. Gideon pitched his half-load of caliche over the side.
How come you let him name you like that?
He's a lieutenant. A lieutenant does whatever he takes a notion to.
Making you his pet nigger is what he's doing.
Gideon didn't know how to meet Dempsey's malice.
It ain't so.
He couldn't admit that he agreed. He had a strong feeling it was not at the root of his difficulty with Nettles. A sense of guilt hung over Gideon, and a sense of helplessness. He hadn't asked for this. Slave society had structured itself into lairs, each insulated to a degree from the others. He remembered the envy and resentment of the field hands toward the house slaves.
Sergeant told us to keep working.
The sergeant. There ain't no meaner man on this earth than a slave when he gets to be a master. One of these days, I'll tell him...
Yes, sir!
Jimbo rubbed a sleeve over his sweaty, dirty face. His smile was thin.
And right after you tell him, we'll hear the guardhouse door slam shut.
If he was attempting to draw heat away from Gideon, it worked.
I've been locked up a plenty times. Ain't nothing they can do no worse than what's been done to me before. One time back in Mississippi, they called me a bad nigger and tied me to a wagon wheel and whooped me because my back hurt too much to bend over and pick cotton. They rubbed salt in where the whip cut me and throwed me in a root cellar without no food or water. Told me to either heal up or die. And come winter, they chained me in a corn crib and they froze me to death. Yankee come finally. They told us we was free to do anything we wanted to do. I taken me a single tree, I laid it up beside old Massa's head. I didn't stay around to see if he lived or not.
He looked at Gideon with eyes of fire.
I take care of myself, and I don't let nobody make a pet dog out of me neither.
Gideon flared. He took a step forward, hands tight on the shovel. Jimbo moved between the two men, probably saving Gideon from a beating. Dempsey could have had him for breakfast.
Sit down, Gid. Rest yourself. You gotta wash that arm.
Gideon let the shovel sag to the ground. He raised his right hand unconsciously and rubbed the place that was still sore to the touch. Dempsey had never gotten to his feet. He had not acknowledged Gideon as any challenge.
I never did believe that arm was hurt as bad as you made out. Just an excuse to shine up to the lieutenant. But you better remember about them white folks, Ledbetter. They only talk nice as long as they can use you. When they don't need you, you ain't no more to them than a dog, and not as much as a good horse.
Jimbo jerked his head.
Old Nettles is coming back.
Gideon picked up his shovel, the anger still smoldering. Dempsey retrieved his pick. He concentrated his anger on the rock, making the steel ring and the sparks fly. Nettles peered critically at the hole.
Mm-hmm. You all ain't a bit deeper.
He glared at Gideon.
Ledbetter, put some muscle into it.
Lieutenant Hollander might play favorites, but Nettles didn't. He gave hell to one and all.
You gotta finish so you can drill this afternoon.
Nettles faced him.
You say something?
Dempsey shook his head, not looking up.
Just working, Sergeant.
He swung the pick harder and faster, attacking the earth as if he were digging Nettles' grave. To Gideon, drilling was harder than plantation work, possibly because he saw so little tangible result come of it. If he plowed and planted a field, he saw the seed go into the ground and the plants come up. If he harvested a crop, he saw feed go into the shock and cotton into the sack. But drilling was like digging a hole, then covering it up. Nothing ever looked or felt different for their having done it. It seemed futile, this marching up and down the practice grounds, learning how to move in straight lines, how to respond in unison to the shouted orders of corporals or sergeants to forward march, to the right flank, march. Gideon reasoned that they would never be called upon to trample any Indians to death. The manual of arms seemed particularly pointless to him. They would never kill any Indians with an empty rifle. They hadn't even been allowed target practice with their War Relic Spencer carbines. Ammunition cost too much. In Gideon's view, horseback drills were not much better. Their only superiority was that the officers and non-coms would stop when the horses became tired. They had no such consideration for the men. Older hands had told Gideon the saber was never actually used in the field. Even the officers left them behind when they went on patrol. Nevertheless, saber drill was part of the routine. Sergeant Nettles had assigned Gideon the brown horse which had surrendered so quickly to the enemy at the Colorado River. The brown was fearful of the saber, turning his head uneasily to watch its movements, white showing at the rim of its eye. He danced and wrung his tail. When Gideon accidentally touched the point of the blade near the brown's flank, the horse squealed and went up like an exploding powder keg. Gideon was not with him on his return. As the dust cleared, Gideon looked up at a scowling Nettles.
Not better. You use a saber to cut the enemy. You don't jab your own horse with it.
Gideon sensed that the men around him thought he needed a comeuppance. The heat of shame came to his face. Nettles saw to it that the laughing stopped quickly. It took Jimbo to calm the brown horse enough for Gideon to remount. Gideon looked down angrily upon the horse's nervous ears.
Judas, I see buzzards flying yonder waiting to make your acquaintance.
Jimbo smiled.
Judas ain't no name for a horse.
It fits this one.
Not until the horses were groomed and fed did Sergeant Nettles divulge that the paymaster had arrived. By companies, the men lined up. After deductions, the little Gideon had left jingled nicely against old Colonel's gold piece in his pocket. Jimbo seemed in some danger of grinning himself to death.
Git, it's time we done ourselves some funnin'.
He pointed north.
I've been studying on going over the river and having some more good whiskey.
Good whiskey? If that's good whiskey, I don't want to taste no bad.
I think I could get partial to it, if I could afford it more.
Well, you can't. Anyway, them people ain't friendly.
They'll be friendly when we bring money.
Gideon frowned.
Everybody on the post has got paid. You heard what the old soldier's been telling us. Somebody's apt to get killed.
Jimbo shrugged. Trouble had never bothered him. He simply refused to recognize it.
Nobody gets hurt that ain't looking for a fight. If you don't go with me, I'll find somebody else. Big Dempsey, maybe.
Gideon considered Dempsey a doubtful choice of company for anyone as easily led as Jimbo.
I promised old Colonel I'd look out for you.
Old Colonel ain't here.
I thought we'd take our clothes over on Laundry Row and get them washed by a sure enough washerwoman instead of doing them ourselves.
Washerwoman? I'd rather have the whiskey.
After supper, the stone barracks emptied as if somebody had announced smallpox on the post. Gideon dolefully watched Jimbo leave with Dempsey and Finley and some others, hollering as if they had no sense. He was the only man left in the barracks, except for an unsmiling Sergeant Waters, who had been in the 10th almost since it was organized. Waters, subordinate to Nettles, kept to himself as much as a soldier could, considering the group life military men had to lead. The only friend he had was an old harmonica. Through it, sitting in a corner alone, he put into sound the feelings he never put into words. Some nights his music danced, some it soared. Tonight it seemed to cry. Gideon had never been able to draw him into conversation, nor did anyone else. Often Waters' eyes were like closed doors. As he played, he was somewhere else, far away.
You ain't going over to the river to stomp and holler?
Waters seemed a little startled at his presence.
I done got that out of my system.
Whiskey ain't all that's over there. They got women.
Got that out of my system, too.
Gideon felt an invisible wall rising between them.
I'm fixing to take my clothes to be washed. Where had I ought to go?
Waters seemed impatient to be rid of him, as if Gideon were trespassing on old memories.
This company been using an old woman that moved in a while back. Second shack from the east end of the row. Name's York.
That evidently was all he meant to say.
Well, thank you.
Gideon rolled his laundry into his shirt and tied the sleeves around it. He started through the door.
If you see a young woman, you walk way around her. Old woman's liable to take an axe to you.
Every frontier post had a suds row of some description. Sometimes the laundresses were wives of enlisted men trying to earn a few dollars to stretch their husband's miserable pay. Sometimes they were single women and widows trying to survive in an environment where survival at even the barest subsistence level was no mean accomplishment. And sometimes, Gideon had been told by old army hands, when laundering did not bring a woman all she needed, or all she wanted, certain ones augmented this income by catering to other needs common to men trapped in an all-male society. The army had plans to build a solid structure for the laundresses at Concho, but so far they were still housed in a crude set of picket shacks, much like the Mexican jacales over the river, except that they were positioned in a military line. The smell of wood smoke was strong. A common denominator of all these houses was one or more blackened pots in back, where water was kept aboil to take out the sweat and the grime and even the lice, so often an affliction of the soldier. Second from the east end, Waters had said. Gideon heard the splashing of water, the strike of a bucket against a tub. He skirted the shack, looking for the old woman. He stopped suddenly, staring with strong interest at a very young woman dipping water from a steaming pot and pouring it into a nearby tub. She didn't see him at first, for the steam was in her eyes. A lock of black hair had slipped from under the big red kerchief around her head, and that too was in her way. She was slender, lighter skinned than the women on the plantation. The unacknowledged daughter probably of some slave owner in the old times before Mr. Lincoln. His pulse quickened. She was uncommonly handsome. She walked back to the pot and dipped more water. She struggled, lifting it out. Gideon set down his laundry.
I'll help you with that.
Startled, she dropped the bucket into the boiling water. She grabbed at the handle, trying to grasp it before the bucket sank. The edge of her long black skirt swept the fire. In her anxiety, she didn't notice the flame that caught it.
Look out!
She jumped back, letting the bucket sink. She seemed to freeze, her hands against her cheeks as the flame spread. Gideon grabbed wet clothing from the tub. He slapped at the fire.
No, don't!
He grabbed her arm and kept slapping until the flame was out. He dropped to one knee and rubbed the wet cloth against the edge of the garment, pressing it to her legs until most of her skirt was soaked. The fire was dead. Holding the ash-blackened wet clothing, he felt awkward and unsure now that it was all over. He didn't know where he had gotten the inspiration to beat out the flames with wet cloth. He could remember no conscious thought process. It had seemed to come to him from nowhere, as if another mind had controlled his own.
Everything's over with. It burn you much?
She didn't know. She bent and rubbed her hand up and down her legs, feeling.
No, I reckon not. I was almighty afeared, though.
I was afeared for you.
Good thing he was here. I might have burnt up.
If I hadn't have boogered you, you wouldn't have caught fire in the first place. I didn't go to cause you harm.
I reckon my mind was on something else. And all of a sudden, you were standing right there.
Gonna have to patch that skirt.
Won't be the first time.
The tears had gone from her eyes, though their trail still glistened on her almond-colored cheeks.
How come you here in the first place?
I brought some laundry over. Looking for a woman named York?
My name's York.
She's supposed to be an old lady.
My granny. She's in the house.
How come she didn't hear you screaming?
Old granny don't hear nothing anymore unless you holler in her ear. Or unless you talk straight at her. She can watch your lips and tell what you say. Get where she can't see you, and you can say what you want to.
Gideon didn't really want to talk about laundry or about a deaf old granny. But staring at those big brown eyes, he would have stood hitched for any subject.
I better go get Granny.
He felt no inclination to move.
I've been here over a month, and I ain't seen you before.
Some of the time I help Miss Colonel Thomas with her housework and her cooking. Rest of the time I help Granny wash clothes.
Well, how come I ain't never seen you then?
She looked at the ground, hiding her eyes.
Old Granny don't let me talk to no soldiers. Soldiers come and bring their washing. She makes me go inside so they don't look at me.
She afraid we gonna eat you or something?
Something. Maybe.
Well, I'm here and I ain't done nothing. Only put out a fire.
I'm much obliged to you. Whatever your name is.
Name's Gideon.
Gideon. Gideon's a funny kind of a name.
Come out of the Bible. A preacher read me the story one time. There was a Gideon in the Bible that was a soldier.
Like you.
Well, there's an awful lot I don't know about soldiering.
You think quick. The way you put out that fire, that ought to count for something with a soldier.
He wished he could feel honest about taking the credit. He wanted to keep the conversation going.
I didn't hear your name.
I'm Hannah.
Hannah. Hannah York. Has a nice sound to it. Hannah York, be all right with you if I was to come over here sometime of an evening and maybe take you walking? It's nice, down by the river.
Alarm came into her eyes.
Granny don't allow none of that. She don't allow me to talk to no soldier.
But I ain't meaning no harm. If you think that, I...
He knew what was in her mind, sensing that even to deny it would lend strength to the notion. A girl this pretty, there had surely been a plenty tried. He would probably try, too, when the time was right.
Soldier boy!
An old black woman rushed out the back door of the shack, bearing down on him. She fastened him with eyes that reminded him of the hooks he had once used to grab cotton bales.
What you doing back here?
So startled that speech left him, he backed off a few steps. He found his tongue and reached down for his dropped bundle.
I fetched over my clothes to get you to wash them for me.
I don't allow no soldier trash around this girl of mine. You got any notions about her? You get them out of your head.
I got no notions. I only just now met her. She caught a fire and...
He realized she couldn't hear him. She shook a long, bony finger in his face. She was a small, wiry woman with an evil countenance that chilled him. She looked much like an aged conjure woman back home, freed by her master years ahead of the Great Emancipation. Folks whispered that she had witched him into it, and indeed she had a reputation for putting people under a spell and turning them into owls or frogs or whatever low creatures her half-crazy mind lit upon. In his later years, Gideon had decided all that talk was made up to keep people at a distance. But for safety, he had continued keeping his.
You got clothes to wash. You bring them to the front door and talk to me. This girl ain't for you, nor no others like you.
Gideon shrank back. He had never been able to stand his ground against any angry woman, and especially an evil old woman. He turned and started away.
Soldier boy! You brung them clothes for washing, didn't you?
He realized he still had his dirty laundry under his arm.
Yes'm?
I can't wash them if you don't leave them.
He dropped them on the ground. He gave the girl one quick glance. She was hurrying into the shack, her head down. He suspected that the tongue lashing he had received was nothing compared to what the girl would get. His first intention was to put a comfortable distance between himself and that witchified old woman. The most open area, free of fences and houses, was down toward the river. He walked briskly at first, slowing as he took a better hold on the rush of emotions, the mix of dread and helpless anger. He began feeling foolish, letting himself be cowed by a little woman who couldn't have done any bodily injury to him. He could have carried her down here under one arm and dropped her in the river. That comforting thought was fleeting. He wouldn't have touched her or let her touch him for a saddlebag of pure gold coin. He stood on the high bank and looked down through gathering darkness at the whispering flow of the North Concho. It soon set his mind drifting homeward. He found himself wishing he could be back there where life, though sometimes harsh, was at least predictable and ran by a rhythm that he understood. He sat down on a flat rock outcrop and stared down at the moving water. The water here was clear and fast running in a channel narrow enough that he could sail a rock across it. Except after a rain, he had never seen it muddy. Folks had told him it came from somewhere north, a day's ride or more, from country that still belonged to the Indian. For all he knew, Comanche horses had drunk from this very water this very day. The notion prickled the hair on his neck, and he forced his mind to other things. Gazing at the clusters of lamplight on the north bank, he pictured the various forms of vice that the devil must be witnessing there. He could hear the occasional whoop and holler of a soldier celebrating the fact that Uncle Sam had rendered him his due. He thought of Jimbo and Dempsey and the others burning their goozles raw on that malevolent breed of whiskey with which St. Angela merchants freed the soldiers of the excessive weight in their pockets. Those women over there were earning the army pay much faster than the soldiers had, and easier. Any love he found there would be as false as the laugh he heard. Only the money was real. Starting back in the general direction of the barracks, he skirted Laundry Row, leaving several houses between himself and the waspish old woman. He looked that way, nevertheless, searching for lamplight in the window. He could see the faint glow, dimmed by plain cotton sacking. He stared a minute, knowing the futility of it. He became aware of a dark shape coming toward him in the night. He recognized the purposeful stride and brought his hand up to salute.
Evening, Lieutenant.
Frank Hollander halted, awkwardly returning the salute, for he carried a bundle under his arm.
That you, Charger?
The name Charger was unpleasant, but Gideon accepted the fact that it had been fastened on him like a chain.
Yes, sir, Lieutenant.
A glowing cigar lighted the officer's face each time he puffed.
Already had your night over the river? It's early.
Ain't been, sir. Ain't nothing I want bad enough to pay their price.
Hollander nodded.
First time I saw you in action, I knew you had more sense than most of these soldiers. Carry on, Charger.
Gideon watched him disappear into the darkness with the bundle under his arm. Somehow he had never considered that officers got their clothing dirty, too. They always seemed to be above that sort of thing. It jarred him a little, seeing the lieutenant carrying laundry just like some black recruit. It seemed, in an odd way, to bring him down to Gideon's level, a contradiction to the training of a lifetime. Reaching the barracks, Gideon walked in quietly and stopped. Waters was unaware of him. A half-empty bottle sat on the wooden floor beside the man's bunk. It was probably a violation of 12 different articles of war to bring whiskey into the barracks, but it was a prohibition honored more often in the breach than in compliance. He entered the dark, quiet barracks and carefully picked his way down the aisle past the rifle stand and the cold iron heater, bumping his toes against the wooden chest at the foot of his bunk. After a long time, Waters' harmonica went quiet. Gideon concluded that the man had drunk himself to sleep. Lying in his bunk, he kept seeing the face of the girl. In his mind, he tried to bring a smile to it, but he couldn't. He saw only fear. He could see a dark shape against the windows. The man struck a match, and the flame revealed the face of Sergeant Nettles. He appeared surprised.
Ledbetter?
Yes, sir, Sergeant?
Didn't you like it over the river?
Never did go.
Mm-hmm. Got paid, didn't you?
Not that much.
The sergeant went to his own small room. He was the only man in the barracks who had the privacy of a wall and a door. Gideon drifted off to sleep, thinking about the girl. The awakening was sudden. Somebody lighted a lamp. Somebody else stumbled into the big round heater. Gideon blinked to bring the blue-clad men into focus.
Hey, Gideon! You sleep?
Gideon sat up irritably, sorting him out of the blur.
I ain't now.
You oughta gone with us, Gid. You'd had the time of your natural life.
Gideon was jolted fully awake by the sight of Jimbo's face. Dried blood streaked it, and one eye was puffed. He looked beyond Jimbo at the others.
You all look like you got in front of some runaway mules.
Jimbo swayed.
Not mules. Mule skinners. We whooped up on them real good. I wish you'd have been there to see it.
He waved Dempsey over. The big-shouldered man gave Gideon cause to fear he might lose his balance. It would have been like having a mule fall into bed with him.
We was just drinking whiskey and loving on some of them Mexican-talking gal. Having a big time. Well, some of them white teamsters come in. You know, the ones that haul rock to build the buildings with. They commenced to passing remarks. Finally, big fella about two axe handles broad, he come over and says, Dempsey, you about the blackest nigger I ever seen. I wish you could have been there for the fight.
How much you got left of your pay, Jimbo?
Jimbo thrust his hands into his pockets. They came out empty.
Anyhow, I got something to remember till next payday.
Especially tomorrow. You better get to bed. They'll be blowing that bugle directly.
Bugle be damned. I still feel like dancing.
Some of the other men took it up. Even louder than the stomping feet and the raucous laughter came a commanding voice.
Ten hut!
Sergeant Nettles stood at the door of his room, his feet bare, his black body covered by gray underwear and blue trousers. His face looked like a winter storm.
This is a military barracks and you are soldiers. Payday is over. Now get to bed.
Clumsily, sheepishly, the men made their uncertain ways to their bunks. As they hurriedly undressed, Nettles' eyes cut like a whip from one to another.
Every damn white man over the river will tell you there ain't no sense nor dignity in a black soldier, and you are bust a gut to prove they're right.
He cut his gaze to Dempsey.
Last man in bed blows out the light, and he works tomorrow and the company sinks.